Ecclesiastes chapter 8. And let's begin with a word of prayer before we begin our Bible study. Let's ask God's help. Father, we thank you for this time that we can open your holy word, and I pray that you, the all-wise God, would impart to us wisdom that we need. You know that there are many things in life that are difficult for us to accept, and I pray that you would give us both grace and understanding in how to deal with these things. So that, Lord, we can be the people that we need to be in this dark world. And this we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, because Ecclesiastes chapters 7 through 11 are a collection of wise sayings, we mentioned that already, the section of Ecclesiastes 7 through 11 resembles the book of Proverbs. There are some commentators that you'll read, or even just reading through it yourself, you might get the impression that it's just a collection of unrelated sayings. And we can give up any trace of logical thought. But rather than just kind of saying, oh, these are just unrelated proverbs, I think it's worth trying to follow the preacher's train of thought through this passage. And this is, I think, a great example of in chapter 7, verses 1 through 17, where we do have a continuous train of thought. And that's why I'm going to try to cover all of this chapter in just this single setting. So because of that, because our time is short and our text today is the entire chapter, we're going to go forego reading all of it at the outset, except for just the beginning and the end. Let's begin just looking at verse 1. Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verse 1. Who is like the wise man who knows the interpretation of a matter? A wise man's wisdom, or a man's wisdom, illumines him and causes his stern face to beam. Now skip to the end of our text, verse 16. When I gave my heart to know wisdom and to see the task which has been done on the earth, even though one can never sleep day or night, and I saw every work of God, I concluded that man cannot discover the work which has been done under the sun. Even though man should seek laboriously, he will not discover. And though the wise man should say, I know, he cannot discover. You see, the preacher has framed this discussion in chapter 8 around wisdom. Shouldn't surprise us. We'll examine that more, that subject of wisdom, in a moment. But consider that some things in life are just plain hard to accept. The first thing probably that comes to our mind of things hard to accept in life is death. Death is hard to accept. When somebody we dearly love has suddenly slipped away, we may cognitively realize that it happened, but it's more difficult to bring ourselves to accept what has just happened. What does it mean to accept the death of our loved one? Well, it's not to approve of it. It's not to simply acknowledge that it happened, but rather to come to grips with, to make do with, to acknowledge and move on in life. And this sort of tension within us between our realization of the way things are and our acceptance of what is just part of our struggle with life under the sun. In chapter 2, the preacher has actually dealt with accepting death without despair. But today's text deals with several more things that are hard to accept in this life under the sun. And I just want to point out the basic line of reasoning in our passage. Since we didn't read through the text, I'll just give you kind of a schematic, an outline of where we're going. So verses 2 through 6 deal with submission to authority. And the preacher is going to warn us that as difficult as this may be to submit to authorities, it's good for you. Verses 7 through 8, he's going to move on to deal with the future's uncertainty. And the preacher is going to say, you can't do anything about this, implying you just have to accept it, that your future is uncertain. Verses 9 through 13, he's going to deal with the wicked's prosperity. The preacher tells us that as hard as it is to accept that the wicked do get away with things in this life under the sun, don't despair. Verses 12 and 13, he's going to tell us, fall back in faith on God. Don't just trust your own eyes, what your eyes are telling you. Verses 14 through 15 deal with life's inequity then, where the preacher says that, yes, life is unfair, but wisdom would have you not to miss out on life's joys for all of life's evils. Verses 16 and 17, finally, he's going to deal with life's, divine mystery. Divine mystery, where the preacher says that you're not going to be able to know everything that God's doing. There's going to be things that God is doing in this world. You won't be able to discover it. You just have to accept it, that you don't know what God's doing. And verse 1, I think, is really the key that sheds light on our text. It's verse 1 is transitional. It sheds light on what Solomon was looking for in chapter 7, verses 28 and or 27 through 28. When he's searching among a thousand for among a thousand men, he's searching among a thousand women. We're like, what is he searching for? He's searching for a wise person. I think verse 1 of chapter 8 makes that plain. He's searching for wisdom. But verse 1 also introduces chapter 8, verses 2 through 17. It prefaces the entire chapter and sets the agenda. Look at verse 1. Who is like the wise man, and who knows the interpretation of a matter? A man's wisdom illumines him and causes his stern face to beam. The last half of that verse, he's saying literally, wisdom causes a man's face to shine. Also in the Hebrew, literally, it causes his hard face to soften. He says there's two things wisdom does for a man. The first is, he uses an idiom of blessing, that it brings light into your life. Are you dark? Are you downcast? He says wisdom lightens a man's face. Wisdom is the key to happiness. Not the happy feeling. When we talk about happiness in the Bible, often we're not talking about this flighty feeling. We're talking about a factual condition of one who is blessed. Like the Sermon on the Mount, blessed is the man that, this is a actual factual condition. And he's saying wisdom causes a man to be happy in the truest sense. Secondly, wisdom, the second work of wisdom, he uses an idiom for transforming a proud, hard, stubborn face to be soft. I think we could say that's an idiom for humility. Wisdom has the power to go at work Wisdom has the power to go to work on you and bring about happiness and humility in your life. Now, this whole chapter is really dealing with things hard to accept in life. So the preacher's message here, I believe, is that wisdom makes the wisdom that makes a man happy and humble is the wisdom that we need to accept these things in life. The wisdom that makes a man happy and humble from verse 1 is the wisdom that learns to accept what is hard in life. That's verses 2 through 17. And while there's no claim that Solomon's making this list exhaustive here, he's going to show us that wisdom compels you to accept five things. Five things in life. The first thing that's hard to accept is submission to authority from verses 2 through 6. Verse 2, I say, keep the command of the king because of the oath before God. Now, there's been some different interpretations on this verse, but I think it's plain that the oath before God is really your oath. It's your oath, your responsibility, your allegiance to God, he's saying, warrants your allegiance to your king that God has set on the throne. So reason one to obey authorities, to accept authorities, is for God's sake. And we see that in verse 2. He's saying your obedience to authorities shouldn't be limited to those times when you understand, when it's convenient for you. We could just think of many case studies in the Bible, like the Israelites in the wilderness. What if the Israelites had said, hey, we're just going to take a vote on whether or not we're going to follow Moses? In fact, they actually did that at times, and it wasn't good. It didn't work out good for them. There are many times where God is going to want us to obey even when it's not convenient, even when we resent our authorities. The preacher here in Ecclesiastes is giving you a good rule to live by. It's the same one that Paul gives the church in Romans chapter 13. So the rule is obey the king's command. Now, there is an exception to this rule. And as Americans, we're very quick to point out the exception to this rule. We're not big on monarchy, are we? But Acts 5:29 tells us we ought to obey God rather than man. Whenever our governing authorities would have us to cross God, obviously our allegiance is to God. We could say a lot about the whole idea of the rule of law, lex rex, being a biblical idea, that there is the law above the king. That's a very biblical idea, but we just can't dive into all that right now. For now, just understand that Solomon is saying obedience to your king is important. It's necessary. In fact, it's warranted by your very allegiance to God. But he gives a second reason in verses 3 through the beginning of verse 5, and that is obey your authorities for your own sake. So for God's sake and for your own sake. Verse 3, do not be hurt in a hurry to leave him, that's the king. Do not join in any evil matter, that would be like a rebellion. For he, that is the king, will do whatever he pleases. Now the the preacher in this case was a king himself. And he warns you as the reader against any kind of hasty departure from what your king commands. Not to be carried away with the winds of disgruntled rebels, whatever's just sweeping up the culture. Don't just be swept away with that. And his reasoning for doing so is that the king is sovereign. He will do what he pleases. Actually, this reminds me of Psalm 115:3, where the psalmist says, "Our God is in the heavens, and he does whatever he pleases." The point is, God is sovereign. Well, in a limited sense, over your life, the kings of this earth are sovereign. And so he's saying, take that into account. Verse 4, since the word of the king is authoritative, who will say to him, what are you doing? The word of the king has power. His very word, with one word, your king can end your life. That's his point. So you better watch what you do. This also reminds me again of God, our sovereign king, in Daniel 4:35. Nebuchadnezzar says of Israel's God that all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing before him. And he says, who can say to God, what are you doing? Who can say to him, what have you done? God has that ultimate power. So everything in verses 3 and 4 really culminates at the beginning of verse 5. Look at that. He who keeps a royal command experiences no trouble. That's the bottom line. He's saying, for your own sake, save yourself some pain, save yourself some trouble, and just do what your king tells you. As unpleasant as it may seem, if he's not calling you to rebel against God, obey your authorities for your own sake. Now, by wisdom, you will know, though, the right time and procedure for when to dissent from your king. Are there times in the Word of God, even that we see illustrated, people who had to dissent from the commands of their authorities? Absolutely. I think Daniel is a great example of this. We see Daniel is one, he's a wise heart, he knows the proper time. In fact, let me read verse 5, I don't want to get ahead of myself. He who keeps a royal command experiences no trouble, for a wise heart knows the proper time and procedure. For there is a proper time and procedure for every delight, though a man's trouble is heavy upon him. Verse 6 reminds us of chapter 3, in verses 1 through 8, where Solomon says, God has a time and a place for everything. But here he's saying, there is a proper time and procedure, and in this context, he's talking about for appealing to your authorities. Even for dissenting from a royal command. Verse 5, he's saying, a wise heart knows what this proper time and procedure is. And we see a great example of that in Daniel, who when the royal court of the Babylonians has set a chief over him and commanded him, hey, you got to eat this meat. And Daniel said, man, if I eat that, I'm going to defile my conscience. I would be sinning against God. This is unclean for me. It violates the law of Moses. What does he do? He doesn't just fold his arms and protest. He makes an appeal. And the scriptures actually tell us in Daniel chapter 1, verse 9, that God gave Daniel favor in the sight of his authorities. Notice the end of verse 6. There is a proper time and procedure for every delight, though a man's trouble is heavy upon him. You see, he's saying a wise heart does not act rashly, even though that heart may be in turmoil about the laws that are being passed. And I think we see a great example of this in Queen Esther. Queen Esther, who appeals to the Persian king Xerxes when her people are in trouble. Remember the story where the Jews are facing annihilation from Haman, who was this like Adolf Hitler prototype. And Esther boldly and prudently approaches Xerxes, and it's amazing. She doesn't do anything rash, you see that, in the way she very patiently and in a genius way sets up the whole thing to make her appeal to Xerxes and to challenge publicly the villain Haman. It's an incredible story. But I think Daniel, Esther, they're great examples of verses 5 and 6 here. So yes, submitting to authority can be hard to accept. It's not exactly popular to submit to authority, but it's what wisdom would have us to do. And the second thing here that's hard to accept and that we must learn by wisdom to accept is the future's uncertainty. That's verses 7 through 8. Verse 7, if no one knows what will happen, who can tell him when it will happen. Actually, the word when there in the Hebrew, this could be used as how it will happen. The idea is no one knows the future. That's his point. I don't think anybody can challenge that statement. And does an uncertain future ever raise difficulties for you? What if I lose my job? What if I lose my stocks, my investments, my savings? What if I lose my family or my children, my spouse? You know, the future holds mysteries for us, mysteries that we can't crack. And we know that life is full of experiences, both pleasant and unpleasant, and we can become paralyzed thinking about all the unpleasant things that just might happen. And the future, while the future is a scary subject, if you're always worried about it, you're going to be living in a cloud of darkness. And this is what Solomon's saying. He's saying this is where you need God's wisdom to accept what he's revealed in the future and what he's not. You have to learn to accept what God has revealed. God has revealed some things about the future in his word. We can cling to that. We also have to accept what God has not revealed. Deuteronomy 29:29. The secret things belong to the Lord our God. And what God has revealed is so that we might do them. We might obey. So sure, no man knows the future. But along with this frightful fact that none of us knows the future is the fact that none of us controls the future. We don't even control our own lives. And that's his point in verse 8, that none of us really controls the circumstances over our lives. In verse 8, the preacher gives us four limitations to which we are all subject. At the beginning, he says, no man has authority to restrain the wind with the wind. I think we could think of Jesus as a counterexample, but Jesus is something else, right? He is the Son of Man. He is the man. But we certainly don't control nature. Verse 8, the second part, he says, or we don't have authority over the day of death. The day of your death may be decided by some earthly authority over you, right? But ultimately God. God is the one who appoints to every man the time to die. Hebrews 9:27. Verse 8 continues, and there is no discharge in the time of war. And finally, and evil will not deliver those who practice it. I think these last couple limitations show us that we are subject to, we are in control over our lives. I mean, you think about the fact that in the sense of context of war, it's the king again, it's an authority, an earthly authority who controls our life in that sense. We certainly don't. We just have to follow orders. And also, he mentions here about evil. Evil won't deliver those who practice it. I think he says that because he knows there's a lot of people who cheat their way, who make their way through life, stepping on the necks of others. And he says, yeah, that can get you a lot of things in life. You think you can manipulate the system, but he says, ultimately, it won't work. Ultimately, you won't win. That will not even deliver you, not ultimately. So submission to authority, and certainly the future's uncertainty and all that goes with it, these things can be hard to accept. But there's a third thing that's hard to accept, and that is what we see in verses 9 through 13. It is the wicked's prosperity. This is something that Solomon has brought to us before. The wicked's prosperity. The wicked use their power, he observes, to oppress others in verse 9. All this I have seen and applied my mind to every deed that has been done under the sun, wherein a man has exercised authority over another man to his hurt. The preacher's examining every deed under the sun, and he observes this situation where a man has abused his authority to oppress another fellow human being. He is using his authority to another man's hurt. One commentator, in talking about this, recounts a scene from one of Alfred Hitchcock's old black and white movies. It's where there's this couple, you know, it opens driving down this road very pleasantly, enjoying the nice day, and suddenly there's a siren behind them, and they see this police car coming fast, looks like pursuing somebody else, but he's actually pursuing them. And this car swerves in front of them, drives them off the road. They hit this low stone wall, wrecks their car. When they get out to make a complaint to these two officers, the one officer hits the guy. He hits the man and says to his partner, "You saw he was going to swing at me, right?" And his police partner says, "Sure I did." Well, you don't know what's going on. And then they get hauled away to the justice of the peace. They try to make their appeal, and they get fined for speeding and for alleged assault, attempted assault. And what happens is eventually you realize that the justice of the peace, the tow truck mechanic and then driver and the police officers, this whole town, they're all in cahoots working together to make money off of people. It's a trap. And it's a classic example of injustice, the kind of injustice that angers us. It grates against our sense of what's right. Men using their authority, their position, their abilities to oppress others. And whenever we watch a movie or you read a story about the bad guy who gets away, that doesn't sit well with you. I mean, there's a natural reason for that. That cuts against our sense of what's right. Solomon's already covered this issue in Ecclesiastes chapters 3, 4, 5. But it's such a sore subject that he revisits it here. So oppression certainly falls within this category of things hard to accept. Look at verse 10. So then, I have seen the wicked buried. Those who used to go in and out from the holy place, and they are soon forgotten in the city where they did thus. This too is futility. He says, the wicked have religion's blessing in their death. These people are laid to rest with praise, with blessing. Now, perhaps the idea of the wicked being soon forgotten here is what the king's lamenting. That's what the NASB reads. That's what I was just reading a moment ago. That would be the idea that the king is lamenting the fact that as the wicked are buried, their wickedness is soon forgotten. Now, that's possible. But stepping away from the NASB, actually most modern English versions recognize that the text doesn't read forgotten, all right? Let me read for you the ESV. Then I saw the wicked buried. They used to go in and out of the holy place and were praised in the city where they had done such things. This also is vanity. And this follows from the Septuagint reading and some other Hebrew manuscripts. The reason for this is that I just have this up here for your curiosity. There's a difference between one Hebrew letter that makes the difference between this word forgotten here and praised in Hebrew, and it's kaf, the letter kaf or beth, and they're very similar, you can see. And so I think there's good reason to scholars recognize why in many manuscripts this word was changed from praised to forgotten. But I think the real idea that Solomon's saying is that when the wicked die, they are actually buried with praise. These people are heroes. They are esteemed. And do we see wicked men and wicked women in our time receiving praise? Solomon says that's hard to accept. Verse 11, because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. The wicked take courage. They are emboldened at the delay of God's judgment. 2 Peter 3:4 makes a point about this, where the wicked are saying in the last days, where is the sign of his coming? They say, forever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. A.K.A., where's the judgment of your God? We don't see it. And they are therefore emboldened to continue in their wickedness. When the bad guys don't get punished, when they get away with robbery, murder, rape, what are they thinking? What's their psyche telling them? I could do anything. There is no God. All things are permissible. Well, there's an application here for each one of us. I think it's easy to think about criminals, right? Those stereotypical bad guys. And yet there's a great example, a principle here for each and every one of us in this room. How do we react when our sin against God, we know we've done something wrong, isn't immediately punished? We don't receive some sort of pain or suffering as retribution for our sin against God. And we can be emboldened to think, it's all right. I'm getting away with it. This is evident in how any child of God will persist in a sinful habit. But we are not to suppose for once that God's judgment is asleep. Remember the words of Moses. They still ring true for us. Be sure your sin will find you out. Be sure your sin will find you out. Numbers 32:23. We don't get away with sin. Now notice wisdom's response to all of this, to all of the wicked's prosperity. verses 12 and 13. Although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, still I know that it will be well for those who fear God, who fear him openly. But it will not be well for the evil man, and he will not lengthen his days like a shadow because he does not fear God. Wisdom only accepts the wicked's prosperity on two premises. First, knowing that it will be well for those who fear God. That's important. If you don't, you'll lose your sanity. You won't be able to accept the truth and the fact that the wicked are prospering. But you must know that it will be well for those who fear God. Secondly, knowing that it will not be well for the evil man. And those who read Ecclesiastes as some sort of a subversive freak who's just giving us a mix of both true and false statements that we have to pick through and say, oh, that's not actually true. That's subversive. When you just look at the statements like this, you realize the preacher has a right perspective. He has an accurate perspective on the wicked. He's not giving us some kind of view that you can just live any way you want. He's very clear there is a judgment coming. But part of the vanity of life under the sun is that right now the wicked do prosper. Many of them do. So authority, uncertainty, the wicked's prosperity, and now a fourth thing that's hard to accept in life, life's inequality. Life's inequality, verses 14 and 15. He's saying life is unfair. Look at verse 14. There is futility which is done on the earth. That is, there are righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. On the other hand, there are evil men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I say that this too is futility. In verses 9 through 13, Solomon's observed the wicked prospering. They're doing evil things and they're getting away with it. But this observation in verses 14 and 15 goes deeper. He's saying, in addition to having to accept the wicked's prosperity, you have to accept that life itself is unfair. For example, it's one thing to observe that the wicked are taking advantage of the innocent, getting away with it. But even in such a case, you may console yourself to know God in heaven sees and he will judge them. But you know what? It's another thing. It's a lot more difficult. It's even worse to observe a world where there appears to be no rhyme or reason behind what happens. A world where pain and pleasure don't seem to be proportionately awarded, justly awarded to both the wicked and the righteous. Righteous people suffering, the wicked experiencing prosperity. What is this? The world seems upside down, and it is that very observation that challenges the notion that there is any God, that there is any cosmic judge in the first place. Warren Wiersbe shares how that, according to the famous trial lawyer F. Lee Bailey, in America, an acquittal doesn't mean you're innocent. It means you beat the rap. His definition is a bit cynical, but the poet Robert Frost defined a jury as 12 persons chosen to decide who has the better lawyer. That's sad, but that is in many cases the way our legal system works. And when we look at a system like that, we can be tempted to think it's not what's right or wrong that matters in life, but it's what's effective. It's what works. But that is foolishness. That is folly. So what do we do when what's happening in the world that we observe seems so upside down and we just can't see our Creator's designs? Well, notice wisdom's response to life's unfairness, verse 15. So I commended pleasure, for there is nothing good for a man under the sun except to eat and to drink and to be merry, and this will stand by him in his toils throughout the days of his life, which God has given him under the sun. The preacher calls you to take pleasure in the simple things of life, eating, drinking, the simple things you need to go about life. And this pleasure or joy that you take from contentment in God's simple gifts, these little things he's given you, will accompany you in the toils you suffer as you go throughout the days of your life, which God has given you. That's what he's saying here. Once again, the answer is not cynicism. It's not existential despair. The answer is contentment with your lot in life. It's contentment with what God has given you, however simple, however small. Authority, uncertainty, the wicked's prosperity, life's inequality. But a fifth and final thing from our text that's hard to accept is divine mystery. And that's verses 16 and 17. Verse 16, when I gave my heart to know wisdom and to see the task which has been done on the earth, even though one should never sleep day or night, and I saw every work of God, I concluded that man cannot discover the work which has been done under the sun. Now stop right there. It's important that we don't miss the subject of Solomon's inquiry here. He gave his heart, he says, to know wisdom and to see the task which has been done on the earth. And then he gives a clear image of what that discovery was all about, the subject of his inquiry. Verse 17, he says, and I saw every work of God. When Solomon describes his quest for wisdom here, he's referencing his attempt to discover the works of God on this earth. He wants to know what God has been doing. And he came to recognize, even though one should never sleep day or night, that is, even though his exploration would be diligent, this guy is a tireless robot, he never wearies in his inquiry. He cannot, Solomon says, discover the work of that is the work of God, which has been done under the sun. And verse 17 continues, even though man should seek laboriously, he will not discover. And though the wise man should say, I know, he cannot discover. I believe there's a fifth item here that can be plain hard to accept. And that is the fact that God's work in this world is going to remain a mystery. You're just going to have to accept that. Sure, you'd love to know exactly what God is doing in your life or in some particular situation on earth. But God isn't going to tell us everything we want to know. He's going to stick to what he said in his word. And the preacher concludes that even if you came up with some explanation, you really can't discover anything God is doing unless he reveals it to you. So that brings us back to the point of this text, back from verse 1. The wisdom that makes a man both happy and humble is the wisdom that learns to accept these things, the way things are, even the hard things in life. Solomon's mentioned several things that are potentially hard to accept: submission to authority, the future's uncertainty, the wicked's prosperity. You have life's inequity and even the very fact of divine mystery. But he wants you to know from verse 1 that happiness and humility, they aren't awarded to you by satisfying all those things, by all of your circumstances, by being on top of the world and not having to listen to anybody, but to be your own authority completely. That's not going to give you happiness and humility. By being omniscient and knowing the future, that's not going to give you happiness and humility. Of course, happiness and humility doesn't come by seeing the wicked get what's coming to them. That's not truly what fulfills a man in this life. And happiness and humility don't come from everything in life being fair. There would still be an emptiness in our life if we lack the wisdom of God. Nor will God grant us happiness and humility by unveiling every mystery of his divine work. No, happiness and humility are to be found by trusting and obeying what God has revealed in his word, by enjoying a relationship, a walk with God that he's made available to us.